So I'm going to start by giving some motivation from ergodic theory. So let's say we have a dynamical system, and this is going to be a quadruple. So we have a probability space, so the measure of x is 1. This is the sigma algebra, and then you have some point transformation going from x to x. Think about this as being invariable, bimeasurable, you know, all the nice properties. And the typical example is the rotation on the circle, some angle alpha. You can also think about, you know, Bernoulli shifts. Really, the results that I'm going to describe apply to the class of all the transformations, so there's nothing specific about this T. And people in ergodic theory, well, some of them are interested in considering various averages along parts of this transformation, and some of them are interested in proving point-wise convergence for those transformations. And here's such a result, which would be the starting point in this discussion. So this is a result of Jean Bourguin. It's from something like 1988 or 89. And his result says that if you have two functions, f1 and f2, in L infinity of some dynamical system, then the following bilinear averages, and Christoph had them on the board at some point. So you want to move t in one direction and say you have t to 2n or t to minus n, it really doesn't make much of a difference. So these averages converge for almost every x. And this is a very nice result. It's quite a difficult result, actually. It uses a lot of harmonic analysis. And there are two questions that sort of emerge from this, from, you know, Bourguin's work on these averages, and which could not be answered, you know, by his work. And the first question regards trilinear averages. So let's say you want to look at, you know, the case where you have three functions. You have the same thing, t to minus n, and then f3, let's say, 2 and x. So what can you say about these averages? Do they converge? Again, assuming the functions are in L infinity. And the second question, also very similar to what Jean proved, but of a quite different nature in the end, is what happens if you have, instead of having t to the n and t to minus n, instead of playing with powers of t and t inverse, what if you have two commuting transformations? You have 1 over n, sum f of f1 of t to the nx, f to the nx. So here t and f act on the same probability space, and you know that f is the same as ts. Now, both questions turn out to be, as far as we can say, quite hard, quite difficult. And I'm not going to talk at all about this question. I'm not going to solve this question here, but the point I'm trying to make is that through the work that I'm going to describe here, I feel that we come a bit closer to understanding this question. And there are variants of these questions in various other fields, in harmonic analysis, in arithmetic combinatorics, so maybe I'll just give some information about this. In harmonic analysis, the object similar or related to the bilinear averages of Bourguin consists of the bilinear Hilbert transform. Let's say DHT. This time you have two functions which are in some LP of the real line. And you want to look at the singular very integral f1 of x plus t f2 of x minus. So there's a bilinear Hilbert transform. Christoph mentioned it. Christoph and Lacey and Celia have proved that it's a bounded object. So here, typically, you care about bounds of this form. Okay, so is this operator bounded? And also, Michael Lacey looked at the maximal truncation of this object. So you look at the same thing, except that now you create a maximal operator. And Michael showed that this object obeys pretty much the same bounds as the bilinear Hilbert transform. Now, this result and Bourgain's result are related, but neither of them implies the other one. What Bourgain did here, well, he used Fourier analysis on the torus, but what he did was somewhat special in the sense that he managed to reduce, he managed to use a lot of, you know, like 95% of his proof is harmonic analysis, but he managed to squeeze some ergodic theory into his proof in the sense that he reduced to the case where F1 has some nice speckled properties. I mean, there are cases which are trivial here when F1 is essentially an eigenfunction, and then there is the orthogonal case where you are perpendicular to the eigenfunctions of the transformation, and that's the case where these guys, you know, behave better. And he looked at this object. He looked at these guys being weights. So the proof, if you're familiar with the ideas behind the proof of the bilinear-Hilbert transform, what's special about that approach is that you dualize this object and you look at that as being asymmetric trilinear form. Jean looked at this guy in a completely different way. He looked at this as being weights. And so his result doesn't imply this one, but there are connections. And I sort of took, you know, the techniques behind Michael's argument for the boundedness of this maximal truncation, and I managed to reprove Bourgain's result by using time frequency harmonic analysis. And actually what you have to prove instead of this one is some sort of oscillation result, which in the end gives you convergence. So this itself is not does not suffice. So this suggests that the approach I described can be applied also to perhaps other averages. And here, the object you'd have to consider for the trilinear averages, the similar object would be the trilinear Hilbert transform, which is known to be quite difficult. So I'm not going to talk about that, but the object in harmonic analysis which is related to that that we'd have to consider would be something like let's say F1. So this time you have F1 and F2, which live on R2, and you have a singular integral of this form. Okay, so I'm trying to prove some mapping properties for this object. And once you understand the singular integral operator, you would go to the maximal truncations, you know, prove the oscillation, and perhaps that thing would be, you know, within reach. But, you know, this is the thing that we are after in some sense. And I think you're going to mention it at some point. It's related to something that Lucas is going to put on the board at some point. So I'm not going to solve this problem, but I'm going to talk about something, you know, a step forward towards understanding this problem. And let me briefly also mention arithmetic combinatorics. This is something that is quite fashionable these days. So in arithmetic combinatorics, people look at somehow the single scale version of these objects. And they care about the existence of arithmetic progression. So, of course, if you have functions, let's say on a finite group, like Zn or maybe on the torus, you'd look at objects of the form, let's see, on the torus squared f of x. If you dualize it, dx dt, this is more of a single scale. The kernel is integrable. And it turns out that this object is bounded by the Fourier transform. So this is O of the Fourier transform. I'm not going to be precise about the bound. So to analyze these kind of things, what this is telling you is that the Fourier transform somehow suffices. And there's a whole theory about density increments and energy increments and how you can use this kind of estimates to get arithmetic progressions in dense sets of the integers. For that kind of thing, the situation is much more dramatic. It's been only recently that people have looked more seriously to things of this nature. So you have dx, dy, dt. And it turns out that the Fourier analysis doesn't play the same role as in the case of you know, the averages I described. This is no longer bounded by the Fourier transform. things are more complicated. There's a recent work of Ilya Shradov. And by the way, if you bound, I mean, why are these averages interesting? What you get is structures in Z2 these times. So you have a dense set of Z2, and what you want to be able to say is that if the density is positive, then you recover a corner. It's a point of this form, xy, then xy plus t, and so on. And as I said, the Fourier transform doesn't play the same role. For example, I can tell you that something like this is big. This implies that f has some correlation, not with some linear exponential, as the Fourier transform is telling you, but with some quite weird object. So this is the correlation with some product of characteristic functions. Okay, so I'm not going to dive into this thing. Now, the object I want to describe, the joint work with Christoph, sits somewhere in between, in the sense that Fourier analysis, full Fourier analysis, if you want, doesn't suffice. You have to do some delicate sort of Fourier analysis to attack these kind of problems. And I guess maybe I should go ahead and write down the things that we are looking at. So we are looking at singular integrals, very similar to those ones. So you have, again, two functions, x, y, but we have T and S. So we have a matrix. This is 2x2, TS. These are really vertical vectors, but I'm going to just write them like this. And here are two matrices. And you want to understand the mapping properties of these guys, and there's also a kernel. You don't look at a single scale. Look at an object of this form. So 1 over T is replaced by this guy. And what is K? K is the Calderon-Zygmund kernel two-dimensional one, meaning that if you take the alpha derivative, some mixed derivative, then it decays something like 1 over TS, the power alpha. Now, you might think that the presence of S creates a completely different problem, but this problem is more general than that one. For example, if you look at some particular choice of matrices, let's say A1 to B, 1, 0, 0, 0, and this one something like 0, 0, 1, 0. And if you look at a particular type of K, so a Calderon-Zygmund kernel, the dimensional one, has some sort of representation. I mean, typical representation is as follows: the sum over all the scales. And then you have two bump functions, psi1 and psi2. You rescale them, scale k, and you do the same thing with each of them. So this is just the rescaled version, and you get something like that. And you need one of them to have mean zero. So either this or that, you need to be zero, or both of them.
Okay.
Yes, you're right, thank you. Right, well, good. Yeah, I should use more of your notes on the board, through this talk. I'm going to reference a couple of times, okay. So, now all you have to do is, to recover that kind of thing with DT over T, all you have to do is to choose this one to be an average all the time. Right, so if you choose these matrices, then you're not going to see any S. You see exactly what you need to see, plus T plus T. But here you choose psi to be, psi 2, let's say, to be the characteristic function, minus 1, 1. So this object is always an average of scale S. There's no S here, so if you average, don't change the operator. And this part would be the sum of, the scale K of 1 over T. So you choose psi 1 in such a way that this thing, this sum here would be 1 over T, and you are done. Okay. Now, the way we look at this object, the way we analyze it is by sort of looking at the matrix A1 and A2, and we only can solve the case where at least one of these matrices is non-singular. So we look at the case where this thing is not 0, 0. Now obviously we're going to solve the hard case where both are singular. And there are a bunch of cases, and it turns out that if you look, I mean, what matters is the spectrum of this matrix A, where A is, let's say this is non-singular, so then you have A2, A1 inverse. And then you can reduce to the case where, well, you can do some change of coordinates in such a way that the object looks like that. And the enemies in the spectrum of A to the difficulty of the problem are 0 and 1. If neither 0 nor 1 is in the spectrum in the eigenvalues, then the proof of this, of the boundedness, I mean the bounds are the same as in the case of the one-dimensional bilinear Hilbert transform, and the proof is the same. Just grab your technology from one dimension and move it to two dimensions. So that's the generic case. The case we are interested in is the case where you have something else going on, and you'd end up having some degeneracies. And I'll say what those are. And so you want to look at the case where either 0 or 1 or both of them are in the spectrum. And before I forget, I have to say that we can solve, well, in this case, we can solve all the cases except for one. And that one is the little brother of the hard problem. So in the case when the spectrum of A contains both enemies, 0 and 1, then you get this problem, x plus ty, and instead of having t, you'd have s. And you can see this problem is somewhat, you know, easier. It's, you know, smoother. You have, you know, two things. It's better localized, but it's still, you know, an open question. I believe that if this is understood, then perhaps the hard problem is not too far. Okay, so what are the degeneracies? In the case of the one-dimensional Hilbert transform, and Christoph had it on the board, so I'm going to write a trilinear form, f1x plus, so this is 1d, beta 1t, f2x plus beta 2t, x plus beta 3t. Okay? You only get a sort of interesting object if all the betas are distinct, and the singularity here, if you see to write it down, it's a line. It's the line which is perpendicular on these two vectors, and also Christoph had this on the board. Okay, so you look at this line which is perpendicular, and then you start doing your analysis. If two components happen to be the same, then this line is gonna fall in one of the coordinate planes. And non-degenerate in this case means, in other words, the fact that your singularity, which is a line, can be parameterized by any of your coordinates. If you know, let's say, the first coordinate of a point on the line, you know the other ones. Of course, if you fall in one of the planes, this is going to fail you. So in some sense, there's only one, I mean, the geometry is easy here in terms of the degeneracy, and there's only one way for the thing to be degenerate when two betas are the same. And in that case, things are easy because if, let's say, these are the same, then you move this one here, and then you look at the Hilbert transform applied to a function. It's an object of a less smaller complexity. Okay, this can be solved. Well, not the same thing happens in two dimensions because each function has two dimensions, two coordinates. Degeneracies can, you know, get pretty bad. And by the way, the singularity for this kind of a problem, okay, has dimension 2. So you live in a space of frequencies of, you know, six-dimensional space because if you dualize, there are, you know, there are three functions, each of them has two coordinates, and the singularity turns out to be two-dimensional. So it's pretty much the same relation. You might think this is, you know, much harder because it's two and it's not one. Yes, but the dimension is two. The point I'm trying to make is that now that plane, which is the singularity, can sort of be degenerate on one coordinate and not on the other one, or there are many combinations somehow, and that can cause a lot of trouble. And by the way, in the case of this thing, the singularity is three-dimensional, so that's what makes that problem a bit harder than what we can solve. Now, I just want to walk you through some parts of the proof for this object, and I want to give you a particular example which we consider more interesting. So in the case when the spectrum of A consists just of zero, and there are two subcases there, the trivial case when you get zero all over the places, but that's not interesting, and the other case is when it's going to be equivalent to a Jordan, some sort of a Jordan block, and maybe I should write down the operator. So you have F1 x plus t y plus f F2 x y plus t ds. So this one we can solve. We can prove some bounds. I'm not going to write them down, but just some reasonable bounds. And why is this object interesting, I think? It is because it contains another sort of famous result from harmonic analysis, namely Carlesson's operator. So I'll just remind you in a little box what Carlesson's operator is. It's a one-dimensional object. So you have an F and some LP of R, and you're looking at F of X minus T e to I, let's say n of x t, dt over t. So this is cfx. So n is an arbitrary choice function. You could also replace it with a theta and sup over all the theta, so there are all sorts of formulations. Carlesson proved in 1966 that cf maps L2 into L2. How do we cover Carlesson here? This is a two-dimensional object. Well, imagine, so let's dualize it. And let's say we have some bounds, right? Let's say we have proved some bounds for these functions, which I'm not going to see to write down. But and let's assume that instead of working on R2 as we do, we localize to the torus. Okay, so the results are sort of similar. If something holds on the torus, it holds on the real line, and vice versa. This is some sort of standard transfer. So imagine here I integrate on, I have four variables, so I'm going to write the torus to the four. I'm going to pick some particular functions. I pick F1 to be little f of x, okay, and then times the characteristic function of the torus, but I'm just not going to write it down. So if f is in LP, then F1 as a function of two variables is in LP of R2. Then I choose F2 to be some g of x, and then I have just my favorite trace function n, which is arbitrary, n of x times y, and F3 to be h of x e to minus n of x times y. If you plug these things in the correct way, there are a lot of simplifications, that cancellations that show up. And you end up having, let's see, f of x plus t. G of x times h of x is like the dual function. I'm going to move it here. And what else do we have? You have e to the power n of x times t. Dt over t. Again, with that particular trace of a kernel, which doesn't depend on t. So you recover the fact that this operator is bounded when you move it, when you evaluate it against this function, it's going to be bounded. And here's the thing that we find somewhat peculiar. It is the fact that our proof to the boundedness of this operator doesn't use, let's say, much of the, it doesn't use math. So if you look to the known proofs of the boundedness of the Carlson operator, there is also, I mean, the analysis is guided by this trace function. I mean, you look at some x and you try to understand what's the structure of this operator here. And there is a concept called mass, which sort of shows up into that analysis, okay, which guides your analysis. And our approach here doesn't see this choice function because actually there's no choice function in the original operator. The choice function is only something that I used, you know, to convince you that this guy is inside here. So that's a little weird. And by the way, the same thing happens with the Haar problem. The Haar problem contains not only Carlson, it contains the bilinear Hilbert transform, the uniform estimates of the bilinear Hilbert transform. It's like, you know, the mother of all the problems in the field. And I mean, in the language of ergodic theory, if you look at the associated averages, you'd have here the double sum. So in ergodic theory, this corresponds to the double sum over N and M. And let's see, you have two commuting transformations. First coordinate means the first transformation. Little t means, let's say, N. This is the second commuting transformation. It's little s, so it's power M. And then you have G. Well, similarly, you only have S to the power, I call that S. So we get that these averages will converge almost everywhere. And these averages, again, contain the Wiener-Wiener theorem from ergodic theory, which is sort of the equivalent of Carlson's theorem. And I should say that by using these kind of techniques, right, so we looked at this problem of general spectrum, and by using our analysis, we actually can prove the following theorem in ergodic theory. All right, so can consider more generally the problem of convergence for the averages F. And let's say I have some linear forms in N and M. Let's say I have L1, L2, X, and similarly L3, L4. So we can prove that this converges almost everywhere if the functions are in L infinity, in all the cases except one, namely the case where this is 0, 0, and you have AN and some BN, which is the Haar problem. So the only problem we cannot prove is the Haar problem. Some of them are interesting. Some of them contain Wiener-Wiener, some others, you know, the bilinear Hilbert transform. And I should say that this result in ergodic theory, well, some of them are trivial. In some case, we cannot prove anything in harmonic analysis. For example, we don't know how to prove this, but we know how to prove, I mean, the ergodic theoretic analog is just trivial. You'd have t to the nx, f1, f2, f to the mx. Well, why is this trivial? Because you can separate. So the nature of the kernel here, because you deal with averages, is in such a way that you can separate. You can have the linear average for F1 and then for F2, and you just invoke Birkhoff's theorem and you're done. So whenever we are in trouble from the harmonic analytic point of view, we are saved by the nature of the ergodic theoretic problem. But in most of the cases, like, for example, the one I described, you need harmonic analysis to prove it. Okay, now very quickly, I would like to say something about the proof, and I'll just sort of focus on this case. So in the case, let me briefly remind you how the proof of the bilinear Hilbert transform goes. So if you have lambda, the trilinear form, so this is again 1D. Okay, let's say you have the one with the beta 1, beta, the beta 3. It turns out that you can discretize this as a pair product or sum of pair products. You have the sum over S And these are the what you call multi-tiles or tiles. And the model looks as follows. F1 phi S1, F2 phi S2, F3 phi S3. Okay, so what are these? So S1, S2, S3, I mean the time frequency picture would be as follows. And the most simplified object would be to look at them as sitting like in this picture as a stack. So Si is a given time interval times corresponding frequency. They all have area 1. You start with a generating function phi, and then you rescale that function and you modulate it so that it fits inside your favorite box. So phi s would be L2 normalization, phi, then x minus the center of the time interval, you rescale it, and then times the modulation. Okay, so it's a rescaled hard function. Morally, this sits inside your favorite box. In time, is quasi-localized in IS, and in frequency, lives precisely in the frequency that you want. So this is, for example, omega s2. And how do you analyze such an object? Well, you put the absolute values, and then you realize that you look at trees. So I'm gonna do 3 pictures this time. Okay, the first one refers to the localization of F1. So you're gonna see IS and omega S1 here. Okay, and similarly for F2 and F3. And it turns out that the objects that play, you know, the most important role into this analysis are the trees. So you want to look at things that overlap, right? Something like this. Okay, so you'll have a top interval, and you have the property that IS is inside IT, and there is a top frequency xiT. This is going to be in omega, let's say, S1. This is S1, S prime 1, S double prime 1, and so on. And overlapping is bad, okay? But what happens is that on the other coordinate, just the nature of these things, on the other coordinates, the things are going to be what we call lacunary. So they're going to sit on the top of each other. If this is S1, then, well, F2 is somewhere higher. And it turns out that this is overlapping, and this is lacunary. And so is the case here. So for a 1 tree, this is what you call a 1 tree on the first component. 1 overlapping tree is going to be lacunary. So if you restrict attention to a tree, you can use L infinity and then L2 estimate. You can square some of these components because they live in different regions of the time frequency, and that's what saves the day. Now, in the case of our operator over there, you might run into trouble in the sense that it might happen that you have overlapping on 2 positions and you have lacunary just on the 3rd one. So this tree cannot be played. And I'll briefly describe what happens. So just look at this guy. Just focus on that. What I'll do is I'll, you know, first decompose the kernel, so I'll replace the K of TS with a sum of psi K of T, say 1, 2 of S, ETS. I'll assume that's 2 cases, one, this one has mean 0, and second is one, this one has. I'll assume this one has mean 0. can think about this as being an average. So I'm not going to play the Gabor basis game here, because actually that's going to turn the operator to something unbounded. And also, you see, in the case of the one-dimensional Hilbert transform, what you do is you localize in all the for all the functions in the frequency, and you split into three frequencies, and you're going to end up having this kind of patterns. If you play the same game here, if you split this one in frequency here, and of course there's an F3, if you dualize it, so if you localize in all six frequencies, the operator is unbounded, the model operator is unbounded. Okay? And this is somehow the main difficulty of the problem, and that's where, you know, our main advance lies. For this kind of a problems, what we do is we say, okay, I see a degeneracy, and the degeneracy can be observed by realizing that you have the pointwise product here, x times x. Now, if you want to prove that the product of two functions, let's say in one dimension, is bounded, you're not going to do any fancy, you know, decompositions there. You're going to Hölder it. And so we are not going to decompose this frequency and that frequency. Okay? We're just going to use this kind of localization to sort of split the operator into a model sum. And let me denote by PK 2 of F1 the projection on frequency 2 to the k. So this would be F1 cap. I only take the Fourier transform in the second variable. I localize to minus 2 to the k, 2 to the k, xc, e to I, yxc. Okay? Just the projection on the second coordinate, overlapping projection. And then in general, you also want to know how to project on some interval omega on the first or second coordinate. Let's see, the first one, this would be as you expect, f hat, well, this time is c y, and then 1 omega c e to x c. So this is the notation I'm going to use to split that operator into little pieces. And as I said, I'm not going to use a Gabor frame, so I don't want to localize in time right away. I'm just going to localize in frequency. I want to see what kind of patterns do I see, patterns of those types. Do I see stacks of that form? And if you just, you know, use the fact that this is, you know, lacunary projection, it means zero. This is, you know, overlapping projection. I mean, if you just sit for 1 minute, you realize that the way you could write this form is as follows. So I immediately see that F is the only guy, so there is a projection on the second component, and it's PK, F1. Then these two guys kind of combine to produce a projection on some omega on the first coordinate. The second term would be, I mean, you'll have to trust me if you don't see it. It's not complicated. And then you have P omega tilde, I'm going to say that in a second, 2 F of xy. And then on the third component, see, I'm not touching the first variable of F2 and F3, so you have something like minus omega tilde F3 xy, dsdy. Okay, so the operator localizes as follows. So omega here is any interval of length to the k. So I'm summing up over omega dyadic of length of the k, and then I'm summing over k. And omega tilde is something like omega plus 2 to the k. And minus omega tilde is as bad or as good as omega tilde. So instead of seeing a stack of three, you're going to see a stack, well, it's a two-dimensional stack, sort of, because the time interval is, you know, lives in R2. But here's the picture. Okay. Now, what kind of trees do you see? Well, you either see a tree with a property that xt is in omega, or xt is in omega tilde. And now if you have that kind of a tree which puts, you know, which makes the things overlapping here, then you have overlapping on this component, overlapping, and this is going to be automatically lacunary. This is all the time overlapping because of the projection near the origin. So you'll have just barely some lacunarity on that first component. And you can see that you cannot play the game I indicated before. You don't have enough, you know, lacunarity. And what do we do to save the day? We play with the time frequency projections. So in the case of the one-dimensional Hilbert transform, for each of the functions you do a one-dimensional analysis. It's one-dimensional in time, one-dimensional in frequency. So you see one of those three pictures for each of the functions. Here it turns out that you have to play a full two-dimensional analysis for this object. Right, so you have something that localizes F1 in both frequencies. However, the analysis on these two parts is going to be 1.5 dimensional. So what does that mean? It means that you have a full, you know, sort of time localization, but only frequency localization on the other, you know, on one of the components. So to tell you frankly, the trees on these components look like this. So a tree, first of all, a tile will consist of the time interval. And then let's call this omega f tilde. So you have now that is cross js is inside rt, so this is two-dimensional. And then xt is a point on the real line, is in omega f tilde. So you see, this is one dimension. I mean, time is one dimension. This is just half the dimension. So you still have trees, but you know, slightly different nature. And how do you prove the boundness? Let's say you want to reach, you know, some bounds here. There are following steps. In the first step we prove some globalizing. Okay? In the sense that, well, it's still localized to a tree, but what you see here is, you know, global estimate. So now I'm sort of restricting the summation to a tree. I insert the characteristic functions of the time intervals associated with a tree, and I end up having the sum S in a given tree. Then I have the integral, of course, P omega S 1, PK, K is the scale of that S, and so on. So I'm not going to rewrite it all. And what you prove is that this guy is bounded by what you want. Okay. It's localized to a tree, but it's global. Now, you have a bunch of trees. Okay, time frequency analysis and the whole analysis of the bilinear Hilbert transform is hard because you have lots of trees. And you want to be able to sum up the left-hand side, and you're not happy with a uniform bound. You want something localized. So in the second step, we prove that you can insert here on the right-hand side, the time frequency, I'm sorry, the phase space projections, F1, P1, and so on. So what are the phase space projections? In one dimension, so let's say you have a function of one variable. This is, again, time. This is frequency. So you have a function f, and you want a phase space project, right? So the function leaves everywhere in time and frequency. Let's say you want to project on one tile. You have this s. What you do is you pick up the Fourier coefficient or the Hall coefficient of that thing. So you have f inner product with a phi s. So phi s is the wave packet that leaves in there, and then times phi s. Right? So this is the coefficient. This is phi s, which morally lives there, and you're done. If you have multiple tiles which are disjoint, you can also talk about the phase space projection onto this region, and all you have to do is, you know, you have to add up these contributions. So that's what you do actually if you have a lacunary tree. Phase space projection for lacunary trees just the sum of the contributions from various scales. If the tree is overlapping, as it has to be the case, let's say, on the first component, I mean, it depends on how you play the game, then you have to be more careful. And that's where the headaches, you know, sort of start show up, because you can't add up all these contributions. You're going to count certain region multiple times, and you know, you don't want that to happen. So in some sense, this thing says that, hey, you have this global estimate, but the function is somehow restricted to a tree. So each function is going to lead into the projection of that tree onto the time frequency space, and you know, you project either on something like that or something like that. And T1 is going to be two-dimensional, and T3 and T2 are going to be 1.5 dimensional. And in the third step, once you have this localized estimate, you start, can start, you know, hope that you're going to be able to add up the estimates on the right-hand side. And what you do is you use BMO, and you say that the projection onto some tree, PI, is bounded by the BMO, essentially John Ehrenberg, times the length of the top, it's an RT of a PI. And what you want to do, see, if you put these things together, in the end you get some RT, because this exponent set up to 1. And you want to do a selection of trees according to this BMO size. So you want to select a tree T with the property that this guy is roughly lambda BMO. And then you want to get some Bessel. You want to control the sum of the RTs which show up, as I said earlier. And it'll show that this is, you know, smaller than lambda to minus 2. Now, when you do this selection thing for these trees, you have to be very careful because you don't quite have, you know, usual tiles. You just have 1.5 dimensional ones. And it turns out that you don't do, you know, as I said earlier, a full, you know, Fourier analysis. You only do Fourier analysis on the second coordinate. On the first coordinate, you're going to get the average. Instead of having the full Fourier coefficient, you get the average of that Fourier coefficient. So you'll see things of the following nature. So you have f of xy. You pick up the Fourier coefficient on the second coordinate. And let's say you L1 normalize it. But instead of picking the Fourier coefficient here, you want to average this over IS. So this is for a given tile. And this should be, you know, comparable to lambda. So this is dx, I assume. And so improving an estimate of this form for, you know, averaged Fourier coefficients, what we do is we manage to reduce to the one-dimensional case, but with a little bit of extra loss, which in the end we realize that we can save. So you don't get this right away. What you get is something like, well, lambda to minus 2, but you also get the L-infinity norm of the counting function of these RT. So let's say you have the collection F of all the trees. This is the sum of 1 RT. You get this L-infinity norm to some small power m, which, you know, you have to get rid of in the end, and then I guess you are done. So I hope I didn't miss too much out of this. And I'll